listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Tennis.com podcast. Ed McGrogan and Steve Tignor back on a Tuesday to discuss the world of tennis and, in particular, a player that I thought maybe we would have this podcast, this discussion about 6-7 years ago after he broke out on the scene. Now, to what degree of a breakout you can attribute to the U.S. media hype, you know, you can ascribe some of that possibly. But, you know, back in 2010, at the U.S. Open, I came away pretty impressed with Ryan Harrison after a match I watched him on the grandstand against Tchaikovsky. Goes down after having match points in five sets. To me, and I think to a lot of other people, Steve, we were kind of seeing the next player to kind of follow in the footsteps of Andy Roddick, James Blake. This is at a time when both of those two were arguably on the back nine of their careers, and we were waiting for that that player to come through. Harrison's gone through quite a bit since then, and certainly, you know, did not live up to those early expectations. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, I definitely think Grand Slam winner was bandied about a few times, and certainly, you know, a title in Memphis doesn't rewrite that script or anything, but it has to be one of the more satisfying titles to see a player win. And as we've, you know, as you and I just discussed, he actually is only still 24 years old. So I thought that Harrison would be, you know, a very worthy topic to start off this week's podcast with.
Yeah, that's you know, definitely the surprise of the week. Harrison had never reached an ATP final, let alone won one. Here he comes in Memphis and wins without losing a set. He had just won a challenger in Dallas. You know, he had been working up to this for a while. It's a surprise that he won the tournament, not a surprise that he's playing better. He talked about it in his speech afterwards, how maybe even less than a year ago he thought he was, you know, he was talking about how there was no light at the end of the tunnel. Maybe, you know, maybe thinking that he really had reached the end of his career or couldn't see, you know, how he was going to get much better. And now since then, you know, since last summer, he had a couple good results there. He beat Raonic. He had a tough match against Berdych. He has played well in challengers, you know, really made himself more solid player. The weaknesses that we saw early from him, the backhand was never, you know, wasn't a strong shot for him. You know, it doesn't seem to me that he's changed his game or become a new player. It's just a much more solid at the things he does, plays, you know, baseline, pretty much meat and potatoes, baseline tennis, but has really made himself, you know, more a professional level at that over the last couple of years. His, you know, in beating Raonic at the U.S. Open, that was a very solid, mature win. You know, maybe, you know, you look back and you think when he was 18, I remember him saying, you know, he was a big press conference after losing to Tchaikovsky in five sets when he was 18 at the Open. And he talked about how he wanted to win Grand Slams. He had goals to be number one. And everybody, you know, people thought that was believable then. But he had to stop and say, you know, all I've done is really win one match at a Grand Slam. And it was true that, you know, the hype machine was on for him.
And the hype machine, it was a win over Ivan Ljubicic in the first round of that Open, if I recall, that really set it into motion. Then you have the matches you and I have both mentioned there. You know, for Harrison, he's always struck me as, you know, we've talked about it. You just talked about a press conference, a speech afterwards. I've talked to him a couple times for stories. You know, he's a very introspective guy. I think you sort of, in a way, allude to it's not what he is necessarily doing physically different, but more of his sort of his just focus and mindset going into matches here. When I talked to him about that match for a piece for Tennis Magazine 5 years after it happened, he he recalled long sequences, you know, drawn out points with absolute pinpoint accuracy. And he's always been one of the more well-spoken players on tour. I've always sort of taken that away from him. I think there's a, and I almost think that was a thing that made a lot of people pull for this, for Harrison early on. I think he had that appeal of someone that was kind of a little different than the typical mold, even though he's, you know, he's an academy kid through and through, going up through Bollettieri's in Bradenton. But I guess to me, that's one thing I thought about right away after, you know, after seeing this win, is like, you know, kind of really like, oh, like finally he managed to pull it all together. Cause you feel like he almost is sort of a tennis encyclopedia, kind of a sort of a mini savant, like of knowledge and of his, you know, his love of the game, but it just really hadn't come out, you know, in one piece until this week.
Yeah, I think that's one reason why people thought he was going to be good, because he was so good at talking about tennis, so good at analyzing it. He seemed to know it as well as anyone. His father is a tennis coach. You know,
his brother plays as well.
Yeah, I think that was part of his appeal and what made people really believe in him early on. And he is a good guy to listen to talk about tennis. He always has been. I think his politics can rub people the wrong way on Twitter. Some people like it. I think he's popular with other players. And I think he wants to go on and either be an analyst or get involved in the hierarchy of the game. I think, you know, he's good at those things. He's always been an interesting guy to listen to, analyze his own game, analyze other games. I think he's somebody that American tennis fans root for, because, you know, he's already, you know, he's only 24, but he's already seems like he's on a comeback trail, or as, you know, he's already somebody you can look at as somebody who's making his way back. You hope that continues for him.
He actually saved 12 for 12 in break points in that match. And he, in every service game in the final set, saved a break point along the way, 10 for 10 overall. I thought his serve was very, very strong in this one. And he moves into the top 50, matching, I believe, at number 43, which matches a career high. For him, it's, you know, getting, you know, what this really does actually is give him some more kicks at the can when it comes to the March Masters events in the U.S., getting into Miami and Indian Wells. You've typically seen Harrison in qualifying draws for the Slams for the past couple of years, and this will enable him, you know, really some more opportunities to kind of build upon that ranking, prize money, you know, the things that we don't often associate with tournament winners after an event, you know, typically just because those are not concerns that that they have. But for Harrison, it's really kind of opens up a lot of new doors, and we'll have to see what he does with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for, you know, for the rest of the weekend, I think the other big story is Karolina Pliskova, who, you know, as of this recording, is out of the, you know, the very next tournament she played in Dubai. But, you know, you can almost, I think that's quite understandable considering what she had done in the Australian Open, in Doha, also Fed Cup as well. Pliskova, you know, before this week, getting off to, I believe, a 15-1 start in the season. And, you know, even though it was a, you know, didn't, still has that question of the slam, of course, that's going to really trail her. But this is a fantastic start to the year for her nonetheless.
Yeah, I think she takes, you know, the wins over Venus and Serena at the U.S. Open. She really seems to have really started to take herself more seriously as a challenger for the top spot and the big tournaments. Now she's 24, just like Harrison, but she's really just coming up for the first time. I think just really realizing how good she can be. You know, we all have known that her hitting, her shot making is as good as anybody's, but now putting it together and maybe just being a little more ambitious for herself, being, you know, she started to talk about winning a Grand Slam, you know, when she can do it, what tournament, which one she could win, you know, being specific about it in a way. And she is ranked third. She almost won the U.S. Open last year. It's all very it's all very plausible. She still needs to be get that consistency. She still plays a low margin game. She's still going to have early losses. That I don't think that's ever going to go away. And I don't know if I see her, Pliskova, as a number one player for, you know, for a long period of time. I don't know if she's steady enough for that. But you start to really think she's a logical sort of Grand Slam winner, a woman's Grand Slam winner, in that power is her game. You know, a lot like Kvitova. She's working with Kvitova, you know, fellow Czech player. She's working with Kvitova's old coach. So you sort of see those possibilities for her, especially on hard courts.
I think the way I look at how you describe Pliskova is that if we're looking at, you know, maybe successors to number one down the road, that's when you look at the more consistent week-to-week players of Kerber, Halep, Radwanska, players of that sort. But we've really, you know, aside from a few occasions, have not really labeled them as the greatest threats to a Serena Williams, to the biggest names and the biggest matches. And maybe that's where Pliskova fits in. And maybe, you know, really that's a label I think we've given to her countrymen, Petra Kvitova, another player who, although she had a very good shot at number one a few years ago, and of course is sidelined right now, her MO is the player that you don't want to play on any given day, because her game has that, you know, those heights that she can reach here. And I think that's what we're seeing with Pliskova. But of course, now it's really, you know, been a pretty long stretch of consistent play too. So I think you're kind of really seeing Pliskova arrive, you know, all around at, you know, something of a peak level at this point.
Yeah. This spring will be interesting. Indian Wells, Miami, hardcore tournament. She should do well. Clay, probably not her thing. She's even said that Wimbledon should be interesting. I don't know if she's done that much at Wimbledon. I know she lost to Coco Vandeweghe there, but you would think she could play. She could do something at Wimbledon. And you know, she has Kvitova's coach. She's talked about how that could help her at Wimbledon. So, you know, she definitely brings a lot of interest. And, you know, I think she's a more logical Grand Slam winner than Kerber, as far as, you know, winning one slam, if you had to pick somebody who's going to win a certain slam.
So we're looking ahead to slams this year in the summer Wimbledon. Let's look ahead to the Swiss indoors in Basel 3 years from now, mm-hmm. because this is what I want to close with, is news today of your 35-year-old Grand Slam champion Roger Federer committing to Basel, not just this year and not just next year, but in 2019. And you project that out, Federer will be at that age 38, and you know, unless he's saying that to say that he will be playing, you know, Wimbledon and Basel and maybe one other event to retain his tour membership card, it certainly infers that Federer, you know, as he's maintained really from, especially after this 6-month absence, where the goal was not to just be ready for an event, not just to peak for this year. It was to sustain his career for a longer length of time. And it can only be, you know, looked at from a fan's perspective of Federer's as, you know, as just really incredible news that he wants to, and I never really doubted the motivation to want to play this long. It's still hard to take in the age of 38. And, you know, at that point, if he's still playing, you know, he'll be playing guys 20 years younger than him, actually. But that's what he wants to do.
Yeah, I think Agassi stopped at 35 or 36. So this would be taking it beyond. This goes back to somebody like Ken Rosewall, who won a Grand Slam at 38 or 39. It is possible. And we just saw Federer win probably the most physically demanding slam of his career, 3-5 setters in Australia. That comes after 6 months off. I guess that's the question, is if he commits to, you know, how much is he going to commit each year? Can he get to 38? He's talked about if he has another serious injury, he talked about how that could be it for him. I think he knows, you know, I think it'll come down to scheduling. This Australian Open was good for him. He hadn't, you know, he was, you know, he was fresh. We'll see if that, how he is by the end of this year, how he schedules, you know, how much the season takes a toll on him. He seems, you know, he seems completely fine. I think he said when he, before the Australian Open, I think he said he planned to play two or three more years. So this makes sense in that way. It's hard to imagine him going beyond 38 just as a number. I would have been hard to imagine getting there a few years ago, but that seems like a logical stopping point for him, maybe that tournament. So, you know, who knows?
I mean, the one comparison I've always now, I'm putting now on with Federer is, and it's been side by side at the beginning of this year, is really with, you know, seeing what Tom Brady's doing in the NFL too. And he's, you know, said similar things that, of course, he'll actually be, you know, he's already older than 38 right now. And it's a, you would think if you could make it to your 40s, you would probably be able to do it more in tennis than in football. But, you know, you see what these two have done here. I think, you know, for the differences are many, but the similarity, I think, is that is really just the insistence that the sport they play really is a priority to them, more than it is to many other players and many other great players, honestly. These two have, you know, I think in them we're seeing really two of the sport's tops, of, among all sports that we're going to see in this generation, really. And I think that it's a parallel that I've kind of drawn between them for a little bit here. You know, after, and obviously after seeing what each of them did in January here, and, you know, for Federer, there just does not seem to be, the talk of when this ends, it's never really been brought up on his side. It's typically been, you know, the story that has been written after an early exit at a slam. Only recently has he been dealing with injury issues that, you know, certainly can derail a player for, you know, and really sort of set on that talk of when is it time to, you know, to really pack the bags. But for Federer here and to have this announcement here, you know, he also was just doing an announcement for Laver Cup. It's really just been, you know, the honeymoon after this Australian Open win, I think, has just continued for him. And it really doesn't, you know, I don't expect him to play much of a clay season, as was the case last year. As I've kind of, you know, really said, as soon as the Australian Open was over, it was already gravy in Federer's career before this 18th slam, but really it's just there's nothing that he can do or not do that really tarnishes anything at this point.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know if he thinks of it that way necessarily. I think he still would be disappointed to lose and or not to win more. He's definitely enjoyed having that trophy. He's turning that thing into the Stanley Cup, right?
Yeah.
The Australian Open trophy. I think he and Brady seem like, to me, like part of the evolution of athletes and guys that are pushing a little further than people thought you could go age-wise, you know, just showing you can, you know, maybe the next generation will last as long as they have. Maybe part of it is, you know, obviously there's more professionalism now and more, you know, more concern and more, you know, the sort of the ability to keep yourself healthy that long. And I think also the mindset that you can last that long. People haven't really done it. And maybe they're that breaking through that sort of mindset and believing they can play until they're nearly 40 or 40. You know, maybe that'll set a new standard for the future for younger athletes.
Yep. I do think it changes that game and really the long game for all athletes here. And that's something that Brady said himself on a pretty revealing podcast with Peter King that I'd recommend. You know, that's kind of the legacy almost that he wants to leave. It's less about achievements personally and more about the achievements that an athlete can do if they really just decide, if they have the ability, of course, and if they really just give it that unwavering determination in a sense, both physically and mentally, of course. With that said, we're going to take off. My computer's about to about at the 2% power level, so we will call this one off, and we'll return next week. You know, I think to kind of wrap up where we see the WTA at after Dubai and Doha, we'll move into the ATP, getting into some stronger field events too as we make our way into March, Indian Wells and Miami. So until then, at the tennis.com podcast, this is Steve Tigner and Ed McGrogan. Thanks as always for listening.
You've been enjoying the tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to tennis.com.